It has been 42 long hours since we've spoken, Irish fans, but your interminable wait is over. This is Irish Illustrated Insider, Thursday, July 24th. I'm Tim O'Malley, joined today by John Bryce of USA Today and Drew Mentock and Tim Priester of Irish Illustrated. Tim, you and I spoke a little bit Tuesday following a 45-minute segment with Marcus Freeman. I want to get JB and Drew's thoughts on that as well. But first, start with some injury updates from the other session. I think as we explained Tuesday, five other websites followed us for 45 minutes and playing chess instead of checkers. I figured there might be some injury questions in that 45-minute segment, so we didn't ask ours. The good news, Kingston Viliamuasa, according to Marcus Freeman, and I quote, he's going to practice at the start of fall camp, but he won't be 100% to start. I am no longer quoting Kingston Viliamuasa's goal, is to make it to the opening game. We'll see if that happens. Remember, it happened for Mitch Evans, similar situation. And he wasn't quite himself in game one and two, but he was certainly raring to go there in mid-September. So that's great news for KVA, who was running around in the spring, guys. That's we were just thinking that's positive news, but football is different than running around. But that's the best news I think they could receive for top-tier players among the injured.
Yeah, and I had talked to his private high school like linebackers coach, and he said you plan to work with him in July. He told me this in May, so I think that kind of confirms that too, that he's been on this trajectory for a while too.
I think I always expected it, and maybe because it's Kingston Viliamuasa, but, you know, I mean, 100% start season, no, but, I mean, good enough for him to get things rolling and put himself in position, and that's huge. Now, Quincy Porter, I'll throw it back to you guys. That's not great news for Notre Dame.
The exact quote there, JB, is not 100%, and it's unclear when he will be, from Marcus Freeman.
Yeah, and that's interesting because, you know, Quincy Porter was one of the guys spotlighted by the program earlier this week for his work in the summer drills with Lauren Lando. And so there's
was Jagasa a few weeks ago.
Yeah, exactly. So there's clearly some physical to that and what they're doing and some mental on the side of who Notre Dame is spotlighting, keeping those guys kind of with that dangling carrot in front of them. KVA, we know he's a relentless worker. We know how naturally gifted he is. If he's able to get back sometime in September and start knocking off the rust, and then Notre Dame's got such an important stretch there after September, so that would be huge to get him. Whatever reps he gets in September will be a bonus for what this staff kind of thought earlier in the year and for when he's most important that he's able to contribute as the KVA we all know and all for frankly love to watch play.
Yeah, I agree. So if he can have that rush shaken off, as you just said, by October 17th at BYU, that's when you really want him back. So if he can get back in early enough and get back into the swing of things, because he's just such a versatile player. I mean, I think I wrote in my blurb that I think he's the best all-around linebacker in the country, and you want him to be at that point when it really matters for them at the middle stretch of the season.
We did talk about, in case people missed our Tuesday podcast because it was a Tuesday, we did ask about Charles Jagasa. Sean Stiers asked about Charles Jagasa, actually. And I'm going to give a quick quote for Freeman so we can wrap it up there. The expectation right now is just continue to help him get in a position where he could play football. He won't be ready to start the season. But at some point, can we get him to a point where he can help our team? That's the goal for everybody. There's a lot more. You can read about it at irishillustrated.com as well. TP, the finalist, I'm asked by the other group. All these guys should be ready to go, and it is a collection of freshmen. Kari Adams, Joey O'Brien, which is great news, Braden Robinson, Nick Reddish, Tiki Hola, and then the lone exception, redshirt freshman Chris Burgess, will not be go for the start of fall camp. But KVA news trumps all that because KVA is a first-string guy, and I know the Quincy. We're going to get into the Quincy Porter stuff for sure because I think we have a question on boundary receivers, which I think is the norm nowadays for Notre Dame over the last 9 months, so I'll take the KVA news because, as Drew said, look, I would have said October 17th is great. It feels like it could be September 17th if this is the news we're getting from KVA.
Yeah, and I think I agree with you, Drew. He needs to be, you know, fully ready for BYU, but you probably want him playing at North Carolina if you can do, you know, if you can get a couple games under his belt, you know, I think that'd be really beneficial. The Burgess thing apparently happened during the summer, right?
In June, it was not part of it. Could happen in the spring, for all we know, but it was not part of the original process. Right.
No word on Osborne?
No, we didn't ask about him either on JV and Osborne. Yeah, I think Osborne, I mean, he should be healthy now. It's the time missed when you have that wrist injury. There's no reason his wrist wouldn't be healed from we spoke with him in February. So surgery had to happen in, at worst, early March. So his wrist should be healed by now. I know Ferebo had his surgery a couple months ahead of Jaden Osborne.
You know, when I, and Ashton Craig, I guess we're still a little bit uncertain there, but you know, I talked to him in the spring and he felt like having gone through the ACL the previous year, he was in a much better position the second time through. Now, whether that was completely accurate or if he was just feeding a reporter a line, I don't know, but I kind of expect him to hit the ground running too. I realize it came a month later. The torn ACL came a month later than the previous year, but I'm expecting him to be really, really close, if not ready to go. Could be wrong there, but we'll find out real soon.
Well, I do think it helps too with like the rehab process and understanding what you need to do too. And it's worth noting, I think KVA, he tore his ACL in high school as well. I think it was his sophomore year as well. I think, and maybe the same one. So it could be a similar situation.
It was spring of freshman year, pandemic season type. That's why they played in the spring. It was pandemic football.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah. So maybe that experience too kind of helps them know what the process, know what to do, and kind of be able to check off those markers a little bit easier.
Just briefly on Joey O'Brien, just following up on that, you want to talk about optimism. I know I spoke a couple of weeks ago about what I was hearing about Ian Primmer and just how quickly he assimilated upon arrival and showed that he's going to be a guy on the field this fall. And no surprise, but in speaking with people over the course of the past week, it's the same for Joey O'Brien. There's great optimism around his health, and there's a great optimism and frankly an expectation that he becomes one of those core four special teams guys much sooner rather than later. And don't be surprised to see him battling to be the fourth safety and the fourth guy that they can use back there behind, obviously, Shuler, Tay Johnson, and Luke Talich. Like, continue to hear really, really positive things about Joey O'Brien.
I think we saw how instinctual Joey O'Brien was in the spring. We were a little bit surprised that, wow, you know, he needs to add some weight and some muscle, but that happens with freshmen, especially if you're a legit 6'5" safety. So his football instincts, I think we saw that a couple times in the spring where he reacted to a play on the edge, and it's like, okay, well, that's why Joey O'Brien's rated where he is.
Wanted to point out that Braden Parks, Chicago Brother Rice High School composite four-star, will announce today with 24/7 Sports' Tom Loy. I believe it's at 5:30 p.m., or at least Tom tells me this 5:30 p.m. I'm going to go with him since he's involved with the broadcast with him. I've seen various updates for 5 o'clock, but Tom says 5:30. I am going with that. And guys, before we get to a couple questions in this segment, I wanted to get both Drew and JB's thoughts on just kind of going over the Marcus Freeman stuff that you read, that you heard, and kind of some things that maybe lingering questions or some answers you received from that.
Go ahead, Drew.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's always good to, especially in that setting where you can maybe ask some big picture stuff that's a little harder to get to during the season when there's so many more pertinent things. But I mean, I always think it's good to even learn they are using AI in some capacity as thoughts on the 5-for-5 rule and you know, the ability to get players involved sooner and stuff like that. I thought you both, TP and TO, asked some good questions. And I thought it was really good, TO, about the adding two cornerbacks when you maybe already had one of the best cornerback rooms in the country and how you get to deal with that. And I was cool to see him kind of sound like he was pretty frank, be like, what do you want, more money? Like, just embrace this. Like, you guys are all good, and just like preaching the competition stuff. So I think a lot of it kind of falls in line. And I also thought it was an interesting perspective too from one of your questions, I believe it was, TP, where you talked to him about his comments that he wanted to retire at Notre Dame, and his thought process was that he didn't want to come across as arrogant, which I thought was interesting. I know he's probably trying to get ahead of some of the narrative from the off season, where I know that's maybe hurt them a tiny bit in recruiting, where he was, you know, obviously at least engaging with NFL teams, but maybe he thought he overdid it. But I thought that was an interesting way for him to respond and not just kind of double down on those comments.
Well, he couldn't say, we kind of laughed about a little bit with him because he couldn't, like after 2 years, he couldn't say, I want to retire from Notre Dame. Fans would say, well, we'll determine whether you're good enough to stay here as the head coach in Notre Dame. And then, of course, you play in the national title game in 2024 and everything changes there. But yeah, you know, I did want to jump back to Braden Parks. I wrote about him in today's Thursday Thoughts. I said we expect him to sign with Notre Dame. So if he doesn't, it's not a jinx, because there's no such thing as a jinx. It's because he just couldn't pick Notre Dame. But we definitely anticipate that Notre Dame is going to be his choice late this afternoon.
No such thing as a jinx. Tell that to your Cubs and their billy goat all those years.
I'm not responsible for that, JB.
But see, this is why they had to bring us back together, TP, for a banner like this. But to your point about Parks, I actually this week spoke to someone who previously worked in the Notre Dame recruiting office, not in the Freeman era prior to that. And he's got a much better historical perspective on Notre Dame recruiting than I do. But I'd said, tell me if I'm off base here. I feel like, especially if they go ahead and nail down Parks and hang on to this class more or less intact, I think this is going to be potentially Notre Dame's best recruiting class since the Lou Holtz era. And again, this person had worked in the football office, and he immediately and wholly agreed with me and said it would rival some of the greatest classes potentially that Notre Dame ever assembled in modern era college football. So I think that's obviously testament to all those guys and a little bit of historical perspective of what we're all seeing here, the way that Notre Dame is recruiting. In terms of your all's visit and the other visit with Marcus Freeman, I thought he deftly handled the NFL talk. It won't go away just because of what he says in May or April or July, especially if Notre Dame does what we all think Notre Dame can do this year. But I thought it was wise the way that Marcus Freeman handled it. I talked to T.O. knowing that we were doing the pod today and wanted to kind of compare his visit with you guys to my visit with him earlier this spring. And I like just continuing to hear about how Marcus, the challenge, everything ties into you guys asking him about the defensive backs, because that's what he does. He tells people to challenge everything, and he challenged them to find your role and be a value add to the team, and the money will take care of itself. And I think Marcus Freeman, in speaking with people in the program this week, continues to challenge himself and find different ways to grow and be better. And I know that when he ultimately decided to stay at Notre Dame, he used that NFL process to challenge himself and make himself better. So those are some of the things that stood out to me. I got him a little bit more in depth on the competitiveness between him and CJ Carr. And again, I'll be writing on that probably in August for USA Today. But Marcus flat out told me, like, I won't play ping pong with him anymore. And I talked to some other people in the program who are like, you can't play ping pong with him because if you happen to be beating him, he will not let you leave the building. Those are the stories that I love. CJ Carr continuing to merge as a true alpha, not just on the offense, but in that entire locker room. And I think he's even watched film, and I'm sure you guys will be talking to him pretty early in August. I think he's even watched film with some of the defensive staff and said, teach me the game through your eyes. So those are just a few things I wanted to impart from reacting to your all sessions with Marcus Freeman, and also just continuing to compare it to my session. And then also, you know, the things that we're hearing over the course of the summer.
We had a question actually that fits here in segment one after what we just talked about from ND Dan 106. If you had to point to one aspect of Marcus Freeman's development as a head coach that stands out above the rest, what would it be? And how does that growth position Notre Dame to compete for the national title this year?
You know, the first thing that comes to mind is when he was talking about trust and, you know, how have you gotten to the level that you're at? And he said, I trust the people around me. That's difficult. I mean, think about being your first head coaching job is at Notre Dame. And to say that, you know, you're going to trust all these components, all these moving parts around you, that's not easy to do, because you want to bet on yourself. You want to believe in yourself having the answers to all these things. And maybe he had to learn that the first couple of years, but that was the one thing that jumped out at me, the self-scouting thing, which I, you know, he fascinates me many times. He talked about self-scouting after the season, and it wasn't just the coaching staff. It was the medical staff. It was nutrition. It was the staff that deals with the media, is everybody in the organization. And that is Marcus Freeman's probably his greatest strength, the ability to pull all of it together and make everybody around him feel like, hey, you're playing a significant role here, even though it might be a very minor role in the big picture.
I don't think the strength staff and the nutrition staff play a minor role in September, though. I think
I'm not talking about them.
Yeah, I think it's a real big deal.
I'm talking about some of the other peripheral people that you wouldn't normally think when you talk about self-scouting, but that's including them to be a part of the process. He continues to come up with great ways to motivate the entire organization.
Yeah, and I apologize, T.O. I probably stepped on this question a little bit with my answer to the first question about Marcus's session and all of that. But again, the challenge, everything, you know, we got a faithful listener, Marine in Iowa, who's a dedicated Irish Illustrated Insider listener. And she's also a Braves fan. So I never heard Brian Snitker talk about getting better. I do nothing but hear Marcus Freeman talk about getting better. And then when I talk to the people in the program that make up Notre Dame football, they all talk about the fact that, like, it's never lip service. Like, Marcus, they don't see a clip of Marcus on First Take or whatever and say, he's never said that to us. They're all like, yeah, what he goes and tells you guys is exactly who he is every day. He is completely invested in getting better. Where I've seen Marcus grow the most, the trust thing is one. He's a much better game day coach now than he was, which is to be expected. And also, I think the trust thing and the game day stuff kind of ties in with hiring well. And Marcus has certainly improved in that regard and found people that are not just good coaches, but good fits. And those are the elements where I've seen him grow and evolve the most, in my opinion.
Yeah, I honestly just want to second both of those answers. That's where I was leaning to. The trust thing definitely stood out, and his ability to hire with that and even get creative, because even Mike Martin wasn't maybe the guy at the very top of his list, but he, when things maybe didn't work out right away with the top target from Texas Tech or somebody they're talking to, he kind of adapted the situation and brought into somebody who didn't have that level of experience in college, but still gave him a lot of trust. And we've seen how that worked out with them really picking up the momentum and continuing the recruiting process and adjusting when they needed to through the transfer portal process too. But that's a guy you just kind of had to get in. I'm sure they taught him a lot and he asked a lot of questions, but you still need to trust people to do their jobs, even when things don't go perfectly as well.
I feel like he did a good job trusting from the outset, but because he had to, he didn't involve himself in the offense. He openly said, I'm not going to be involved in the offense to start this out because the guys, and you kept Tommy Reed, you kept your offensive coordinator. So obviously it was kind of the machine was running how they wanted it then. But I think learning how to help out with decisions on the offense, but still leaning on what Gino Gadulli and Mike Denbrock and Joe Rudolph say is something that he can grow in the role as helping the, he's certainly not going to step on their toes. I mean, they know what they're doing. He delegates to those guys to know what they're doing. But I think it's important going into year 4 and 5, he was probably part of that overall plan with the offense where he didn't even, you know, there was no reason for him to be at the first couple of years. My takeaway, though, from just to circle back and this segment, my takeaway from what Freeman said was, he said, after a loss, you have to get in front of that room and you have to believe you have the answers. And you don't know if you actually have the answers until you face another opponent. And I guarantee you, he did not think he had the answers after Marshall and Northern Illinois and maybe A&M. You know, I feel like he probably felt like, hey, we can handle this after Miami. When you're 0-2 and you were supposed to be at worst 11-1 and you're 0-2 staring down the barrel of our defense just gave up 40. It's hard to know if you have the answers or not, but he had enough faith in himself to ensure he addressed the room properly. And then they had 7 days to get the answers.
Well, there was a reason why he would have been uncertain after A&M, and we saw it on the field against Purdue in the first half. They weren't there yet. And you know, remember they had a weather delay and everything was extended, and
that was a horrible first half for Notre Dame because the pall of the day of the week before was awful for everyone watching that. Yeah.
Yeah. And then the end of the first half lasted forever and it was all bad pretty much. Yeah. No, that carried over. The other thing for me, he talked about staying in the moment and, you know, how if he would have been like, you know, before Brian Kelly decided to leave, he said the last thing on his mind was becoming the head coach of Notre Dame. And, you know, I think, again, there's a lesson that he can apply to his players, which they absolutely have to stay in the moment play by play. So we said the other day, Tuesday, Tim, when you and I got together on this, I mean, I just thought it was another impressive display by him and another sign of, you know, just what a great coach he's becoming.
We'll be back with segment 2, Burning Up the Boards. We are back with segment 2. We call it Burning Up the Boards. Our first question from longtime subscriber, Statman72, who Tim Priester has met. So I'll throw it to you, Tim Priester. The starting QB gets about 70% of practice reps, which limits the reps available for backups. Given the utterly inexperienced backup QBs on this year's squad, would it make sense to reduce Carr's reps a little? Does he really need to take 70% of the reps in the weeks before Rice, Purdue, and BC? BC catching strays all the way in November.
Yeah, you know, I think it's a great question. I understand the question. I think I think you would have to restrain CJ Carr if you told him he was going to take less than 70% of the snaps preseason, because he was jonesing last year not being able to do that in his competition for Kenny Minchie. Great question. I think maybe you can pick your spots to do that, but on a regular basis, I don't see that happening. All the eggs are in the CJ Carr basket, and they want him ready. I mean, you know, it's easy for us to sit back and say, ah, their schedule's easy the first half, and so they can get some other guys in there. Coaches don't normally look at it that way, and I know CJ Carr doesn't look at it that way. So that's why I say maybe you can pick your spots along the way where you can do that, but I don't think it's anything that they're inclined to do on a regular basis.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think his development and getting him fully ready for the playoffs is how you have a chance to win the national title this year, too. So I don't think you want to take anything away from his development. This is still his first, even now, you know, will be his first full fall camp where he's the number one guy, too. So even just looking at it that way. But I think this is where it helps too that Notre Dame does a lot of that two spot where they're getting more guys on the field. The roster is now bigger with scholarship guys than it was a few years ago, too. So I think it's just going to be being really efficient, which I know is a priority in practice, and getting those other quarterbacks as many reps as possible. But I don't think you should take anything away from CJ Carr other than if it's a planned rest day or a light day. But that's for his development. I don't think you take anything from him to help a backup quarterback, even if they need to figure that out.
Yeah, you kind of stole my answer there, Drew, because I was definitely wanting to highlight the two-spot technique that Notre Dame deploys a great deal, which is getting you 44 guys concurrently practicing out there in Notre Dame's practice space there adjacent to the IAC, or sometimes inside the IAC. They still have the ability to go on the outdoor fields. And so the fact that they're able to concurrently run that practice with 44 guys getting reps at any given time, I think is huge. We know that Marcus Freeman fastidiously plans his practice schedule, the camp schedule, the way that he wants to operate, all of those components. And it's barely been maybe 11 months since CJ Carr was actually even named the starter. And so it's certainly a valid question and a salient point there. But you've got to hyperload CJ Carr going into this year, because this is the year. You're built to win a national title this year. I think the field shapes up for you to be a legitimate national title contender from beginning to end. And so for all of those reasons, and you take care of CJ Carr for sure, and you find your spots to get him in. But I don't think preseason camp is where you reduce it, when it was like August 18th or something, I think, last year that CJ Carr was named the starter. So he's still got to get the work. The numbers are out there. I think TO's had some of them, or some of the others of what CJ Carr did against better competition last year. So while I think he's splendid quarterback and has tremendous upside and has already shown tremendous ability, there's still more to be unlocked.
I have five names for you: Jaden Greathouse, Micah Gilbert, Ian Premmer, Mylon Graham, backup running back. They all need CJ Carr. CJ Carr has to work with all those guys because he needs 70% of the reps with those guys. Jordan Faison's plug and play, throw him out there. He and Carr have an absolute rapport right now. He targeted Jaden Greathouse 8 times in 4 games when healthy last year. He needs to get up, and he didn't see him in the spring on the field. They need Jaden Greathouse work with CJ Carr. You need Micah Gilbert going to up and catch a ball that CJ Carr throws that you can catch, rather than letting the guy knock it away from you just because you feel like running under a ball and not jumping for it. So you need these reps with CJ Carr. It's the 30% that's hard for Gaudule. I don't think they start August 6th. Somewhere on August 13th, his fourth quarterback gets 10%. You have to knock it all the way down to find out your number two and your number three. When you hit August 20th, the backup quarterback gets 25%, while CJ Carr gets 70, and the third string guy. Freeman has mentioned he probably got to keep a third guy up on off a scout team so he can learn, but that's 5% of the reps. So the way it is, I mean, if you had Kenny Minchie, you wouldn't worry about it, but they don't. And you got to get CJ Carr ready, because as they say, you don't practice screwed. Without CJ Carr, you're screwed. So you practice CJ Carr.
Who do you guys think is going to win the number two job? And
I don't know.
You got three freshmen.
I mean, win the number two job that's posted on August 23rd, 24th, or no, I guess it'll be September 1st, but it's posted
which, you know, Freeman acknowledged could change as you get into the season. But yeah, who do you think it'll be?
Oh, I think probably by mid-October, it's Teddy Girard. Maybe to open the year, it's Noah Grubb.
That's where I am.
That's who I think too.
I think Grubbs will be listed.
I think, and also drives to this question, and we discussed it maybe on last week's podcast, but the PLP, the player-led practices, like how valuable is that work right now for those backup quarterbacks? What are they learning from CJ Carr? Because again, the people I talked to are like, CJ Carr has been take charge. It's his offense. It's in a lot of ways becoming his program. And so are they sponging off of CJ Carr? Are they then organizing some stuff when a player-led practice continues? When a player-led practice ends, are those guys continuing to get work with some of the other key people so that they are positioned to maximize the volume of reps that they're getting in the summer, even if they're unofficial reps? Those coaches know. Those coaches talk to the players to find out how those player-led practices are going. And then, as we noted, there's the 8 hours a week that the coaches are allowed with them in the summer as well.
Next question from NDNYC. Previously, some of you have talked about the allure of the NFL for college coaches because of the lack of recruiting duties. Is that changing with the new structure where there's more of a dedicated recruiting staff? That is, might the college game become more of a destination than a stepping stone? JB, I will throw this to you as you talk to a lot of college coaches.
Well, and this was along the lines of a specific question I asked when we had all the one-on-ones at Big 12 Media Days a couple of weeks ago. And my short answer to this would be, if they don't pass some variation, iteration of the Protect College Sports Act, and if they're not real rules to govern it, then no, because yes, you have these general manager, more NFL style organizations beginning to further pervade college football, but you have these expanded personnel departments, but you don't have uniform personnel rules. And so it's still a real free for all. And, you know, I specifically asked Joey McGuire about this when I also asked Joey McGuire what he would change about Texas Tech's protocol in recruiting out of the transfer portal. And Joey said, I think if you're still in football for the right reasons, then this isn't driving you away from the game or away from college football because you believe in what college football is supposed to be about. But then multiple other coaches said, yeah, it's inevitable. Like, we're making a good living in this, but there's something wrong. I forget which coach specifically told me, like, there's something wrong when we're supposed to be helping coach the semi-pros or the amateurs or at the collegiate level, one step removed from high school. And it's become such a mess that guys are trying to go to pro ball because it's easier. And the point was just like, pro ball should not necessarily be easier than what college football is, because pro ball is all professional. So I don't think that, like, college is a destination because it's a dream for so many of these guys, and so many of them played college football and want to give back. And now the money is greater than ever before. But again, in speaking with a number of coaches over the course of this summer, I think that it has to be some more uniform guidelines, or you're going to continue to see more and more guys either willing to try to go the pro route, or look at Bobby Hawk, who left Montana, who had Montana as an FCS powerhouse, and he left and became Illinois' defensive coordinator over the offseason because of the way the game is going, and those FCS rosters are really at the mercy of the FBS and getting raided.
Well, I do wonder, just as I agree with you overall, I don't think it's really probably changed much. I do wonder, maybe some other changes has made it easier to potentially stay a coordinator at a place like Notre Dame, where you're not going on the road as much. We're seeing them use some other staff for that. So Chris Ash and Mike Denbrock don't have to hit the road as much. Now, analysts can be a little more hands-on. Obviously, Chris Ash and Al Golden before him haven't really had to be the main position coach for anybody too, so that allows them to maybe have a more NFL-like role, even if they're still having to recruit and do some of those things. They're not completely done with that, but I wonder if that's made it a little easier to potentially stay, especially if the money is similar or better.
Yeah, your recruiting staff is larger than it ever was, but the assistant coaches still have to recruit. They still want to determine what guys are going to play for them. So I'm not sure how much it changes that. It's just the recruiting aspect of it in general. In the NFL, it's free agency, and you know, there are people higher up that are making that decisions. And on the collegiate level, the position coaches still have to recruit. They still got to convince guys that, you know, you want to come play for me at my position. So I'm not sure that it changes, you know, that drastically. just because there's just so much involved in the college calendar now that it's just going to be difficult to change. JB, are they going to, like, what kind of changes you think they'll be able to make to kind of pacify them?
Well, I mean, you've got to have a little bit more equal distribution of resources throughout the FBS. I'm not talking about any sort of deliberate allocation where teams get in line and everybody A through Z gets the exact same portion doled out in the college football cafeteria, so to speak. But I think like Rich Rod specifically told me, he said, I get why the SEC and Big Ten don't want the Protect Sports Act, even though it's vital, because they're the leagues winning the most right now. And if I've got a $40 million roster going against a $15 million roster on any given Saturday, why on earth would I want to change that? And so then I followed up and asked Rich Rod, okay, well then how often do you think that happens? And he said, it's happening every single Saturday. It happens all the time. It happens multiple times on Saturday. I've shared on the pod over the course of this summer and reaffirmed it kind of this week that I'm told there's at least 13 teams this fall in college football with roster spend at 40 million or more. There's close to a half dozen at 50 million or more. And then you have a number of teams on schedules that even the biggest salary roster in the group of five this year, I'm told, is in the $11 to $12 million range. So even if you've maxed it out at the FBS level for one of the non P4 conferences, you're still at a third to a fourth of some of the big boys and their outlay. So I think because of that, the Rich Rod point is really pertinent here. And the other thing I would note, strictly from a finances and being a contract nerd, self-proclaimed, is like those NFL contracts are still 100% guaranteed. Yeah. Whatever your role is, if you have a multi-year contract, it's 100% guaranteed with no offset. And the college contracts are still, a lot of agents tell me we try to get 60 cents on the dollar guaranteed on a college contract in case of a firing or a separation.
I mean, if you're Marcus Freeman, you're in a good spot, but let me run this down for a head coach. You have NIL salary cap disparity. So let's say Notre Dame's fifth or sixth in total NIL earnings. They could be $10 million behind the team they're playing in the championship game. Your calendar sucks. You have no idea how to get the calendar better for college football. And if you're Notre Dame's coach, you have to worry about school. You can't sit there and advocate for let's play games during finals to have a 2014 tournament starting after December. You have to talk to 100 agents, because if you don't and you leave it up to Mike Martin and he messes up, it comes down on you, because no one cares who the GM is at Notre Dame other than like our subscribers who are into all this. You just think, why didn't Marcus Freeman get these guys? It all still comes down on you. You're the head coach. Indiscriminate rules for if you're going to make the playoffs or not. And by the way, if you don't make the playoffs, there's no carrot at the end of it, because the Gator Bowl used to be cool. And now it sucks. Like, there's nothing. If you don't make the playoff, you should not ever play a bowl game again. What in the world are you doing? So that would be terrible if I was a head coach. You got to change a lot of these things to really keep them in.
Well, maybe, I mean, these guys are, you know, they're under contract. I don't know how you say, you know, you have to play in the bowl game. And,
tell them to play in the bowl game.
Right.
They know.
my calf is bothering me. I can't play in the bowl game. You know, those kind of things. No easy answers in the college game, man.
Yeah, completely agree there, and like the viewpoints that all three of you brought there. And I would just further indicate that, yeah, the Protect College Sports Act, TP, to your question to me, it does provide some framework for capping agent fees and for having agents at the collegiate level having to register. I've got a good friend who was taking the NFLPA test this week to become a certified NFL player agent. He already reps some college players and already reps some college coaches, but they're looking for more of that. They're looking to cap the fees. And there's a lot of good people out there representing the college players who are doing it the right way and taking 15 or 5%. But there's a lot that are taking a lot more than that and taking advantage of the situation. And again, one of the other coaches drove that point home to me. Like, if you have an agreement with a player and he's going to get $250K or $300K from you, but then his agent is saying he's going to take 15 to 20% off the top of that, well, then all of a sudden you're looking at the price tag to acquire that player because the player expects to get his full $300,000, suddenly becomes $360,000 to pay the agent commission there. So just one other element to consider in all of that. But a great question. I love that. That was healthy discussion, I feel like. So appreciate NDNYC for that question. Let's go to question number three from Maltese Irish, as we know, a longtime listener and a longtime interrogator. Beyond early season losses, what else could be considered Marcus Freeman's kryptonite? TP, I never get to throw to you because they deny our greatness together. Throwing to you first, TP.
Wow. I don't think there's a whole lot of kryptonite out there for Marcus Freeman, but something that occurred to me, this will happen at some point. I mean, he is a high risk, high reward guy on fourth down in his own territory, game on the line. He'll go for it. And in virtually every instance, the offense has come through and or the defense has held as when the offense hasn't come through. One of these times, a fourth down gamble is going to hurt Notre Dame. I don't know if it necessarily costs them a game in 2026 just by the nature of Notre Dame's roster and their schedule. But, I can see outrage. Well, why did he go for it? Well, because he always goes for it, and he has a ton of success doing it, and he's won 27 of his last 31 games. But, you know, critics are critics, and one of these times it isn't going to work, and it could cost Notre Dame.
I can critique something.
Go for it.
Sure. This is pretty simple. What do 2022, 2023, and 2024 all have in common besides September?
Ohio State.
Yeah. What would happen if they play Ohio State this year and lose in the quarterfinals? What does 2025 have in common with 2022, 2023, and 2024? They lost to the best team they played. Head up. Only one time were they big underdog, 2022. They lost at home to Ohio State when they should have won. They lost to Ohio State in the championship game. Yeah, Ohio State was better. They lost to Miami. Got to beat the best team on your schedule. What if they lose to Miami this year? There's plenty of kryptonite. I mean, they haven't won a title yet. They lost to the best team on the schedule every year, and you could lost to Ohio State 3 years in a row. The only reason you didn't lose to them last year is you didn't play them.
Well, but it's not like there are a lot of individual shortcomings that jump out about Marcus Freeman. I know what you're saying.
Has to look critique on Freeman. We can critique any. We've got to be able to critique him. I mean,
of course.
Yeah, I would say beat the best team on your schedule. And if you get Ohio State in the quarters, you want to lose 4 out of 5 years to Ohio State all four times, his alma mater, that would be – there are very few things that will make Notre Dame fans mad. A quarterfinal loss to Ohio State this year would make Notre Dame fans mad. Maybe not a championship loss because, you know, let's be reasonable humans. You're in the championship game, right? If Ohio State's there, they're probably that damn Ohio State team again with Jeremiah Smith. And you just can't – you realize they're better than you thought they were going to be. But – or as good as they could be. But that would be a big one for me.
Yeah, I wrote down his alma mater, too. I mean, obviously, the three losses there. And I think, too, sometimes we see, I think Miami sticks out, too, in those Ohio State games where if a team can match Notre Dame's physicality, I don't think we've seen him really pull that out. Obviously, that's a big reason why they beat Georgia a few years ago, but really be able to find some other answers. And I think this Miami game, Miami has a new offensive line, but that should be ready in November, and they have a lot of talent there too. So how does Notre Dame hold up with that physicality? Because that's also another program that really is built through the trenches as well.
Move on to question number four. What program, we're going to jump into a little bit more personnel related stuff here. What program record is most likely to be broken in 2026?
Drew, you've been preparing for this one. You got to go first. So full disclosure, this got bumped from a podcast, and Drew was ready for it.
So I've
got to go first.
I have two. They're both would potentially be broken by CJ Carr. Ian Book's record in 2018 of 68.2% pass or completion percentage. I think CJ Carr was 66.7 as his first year as a starter. Now, he had a full yard per pass attempt more than Book did in 2018. Carr had that last year. So I think he could, that's the only thing, he does push the ball down the field more, but I think that's absolutely something we could see him break. I think they're going to do a lot of shorter passes, get it to the running backs, maybe even more, especially with Aeneas Williams, dumping it out to Jordan Faison. And I think he's just improving in all aspects too. And the other one I thought was interesting is looking to the record books is the Jimmy Clausen in 2009 against Nevada set the record for yards per pass attempt in a game at 17.5, but you need a minimum of 15 attempts. Now, Carr had 18.6 against Purdue last year, but went 10 of 12 in passing. So I think they're going to need him to be a little more explosive, do more for the passing game. So I think he'll have a game where he breaks that 17.5. And if I'm going to predict, he's going to do it against Purdue this year.
I think for me, great insight there and research that you put into that, Drew. I think that because CJ Carr takes so many more downfield risks than Ian Book did, he'll have a hard time eclipsing that, just because I think CJ Carr's got a little bit more of that gunslinger mentality. And I don't think there's any question that CJ Carr has more ability to push the ball deep downfield. And, you know, it's hard to complete 50% of your passes when you're pushing it deep downfield. So I think that, I mean, when I saw this question for me, I also drifted to the offense. I just sort of thought I'd go with maybe total points scored for the season, I think, because of the length we expect the season to be and the fact that you've got a defense that has a bunch of guys that could probably be starting skill position players elsewhere in college football, from Leonard Moore to Tay Johnson to Adon Shuler to whomever. You've got some dynamic playmakers on the defensive side of the ball to set up potential defensive scores. You should be much better in the kicking game this year to get more, to make sure PATs are suddenly automatic again, and to be able to hit a higher clip of your field goals. So I'm going with total points scored.
You know, I was thinking of points per game, but if you take all the games and you play Ohio State, IU, and Georgia to end the year,
it's hard to do.
You probably don't get 38, 35, and 31 as opposed to 28, 25, and 24. I will go with, and to be fair to the 13-game thing, they can break the sack record of 41.5. I know they can break it if they play 16 games. That's not fair. So 41.5 sacks in 1996, 11 games, by the way, Tim Priester. 11 games, 41.5 sacks, or in 2023, they had 41 or 41.
Ooh, wow. Ooh, that's tough.
I'm sorry, 21. So I think if they had it in 2021, with that line, they can do it in 2026 with this front seven.
Yeah, good point. Total points. If they play 16 games, yeah, that can happen. Do I think they'll average 42 points a game this year? Despite CJ Carr being on another level and will probably throw for a lot more yards and touchdowns than he did last year, if there's a strength of Notre Dame's opposition, it's on the defensive side of the ball. We need to see the offensive line come together. I do like the total points thing, but I'm looking at more, you know, can they get to 42 points a game? I don't think that they necessarily will. On the flip side of that, you know, again, this isn't 1966. They're not going to hold their opponents at 3.8 points per game, but can they approach 12.8 of 2012? Maybe. I think they can, because if defense is the strength of Notre Dame's opposition this fall, offense is definitely the weakness. And second time through with Chris Ash, I think they're going to throw up some single digit and shutouts along the way here. That's the number I'm looking at. And maybe, and again, this isn't all-time record, but Michael Mayer had 42 catches as a freshman. Can Ian Premmer do that? If it's 16 games, definitely.
And
we don't know where he is.
That's true. If it's 16 games, I would say no. Because
probably not.
Didn't have Faison and Graham. And they ran. But I know what you're saying. That's like, he's the first
12 point. You know, the 12.8, can you, I think that's something that they can shoot for. Something just under two touchdowns per game, I think, is feasible.
The fun thing you need about points per game is, like, you know, when you play New Mexico and you score 66 and you play Syracuse and you score 70, that really helps, because it's two games.
No doubt. No doubt.
I mean, if you get to 70 points, it's like a game and three quarters of scoring you wouldn't normally get. Next question, Manatee. This is a tough one, but it came from my question with Marcus Freeman, so we might as well put it in here. You mentioned Freeman ensuring the staff was self-scouting, so put yourself in the shoes of the coaches. What issues or deficiency or even tendency do you hope the coaches identified and are working to resolve or have worked to resolve this offseason?
Go ahead, guys.
I mean, you've got to be better in short yardage, and you've got to be a team that scores a great number of touchdowns in the red zone. To me, those were the two that stood out. I think Notre Dame, if I'm not mistaken, has, in addition to all the self-scouting that's been going on, I think they have their hyper-intensive kind of self-scouting sessions coming up just before the onset of preseason camp, where they'll really drill down and say, okay, I told you to self-scout. Why were we so marginal in short yardage situations? And they're going to drill down and say, well, it's not just one thing or it's not two things. Here's what we found. Here's what we found as a potential solution for this. And some of it will be hopefully your offensive line stays better and they're a year older and stronger and more experienced and you expect it of them. But that's where it starts for me. It's those two areas over just about anything along with field goal kicking, which I think is going to be a real asset this year. And we know that it's not lip service in their self-scouting talk, and they're really getting ready to drill down in that. So for you guys that are going to be around more in preseason camp than I am, hopefully you get a chance to talk to some of the assistant coaches a little more specifically about the self-scouting, because I do think that's fascinating. And it's not just, well, what'd you find? It's what'd you find and what was your plan of attack for it?
Yeah. We know what they found. So what do you do about it?
Right. And I think short yardage is definitely the best answer here, too. I mean, I think especially losing Jeremiah Love and Jadarian Price, you're not going to have those explosive plays. So you need to be more consistent in some of these other areas. Otherwise, the run game cannot live up to even the expectations we have with replacing both those guys. And the other one, I mean, again, to your point, this is more about how do you finally fix it. But if Aaron Henry can finally break Christian Gray of just how grabby he gets, how many pass interference calls he gets, I think that could really change just how good of a player he is this fall, because I think we've seen him have some big moments. But again, that's, they know he does it. We all know he does it. But how can you finally break him of that habit, I think, is a big tendency I would like to see changed.
I too wrote down short yardage, but let me focus a little bit more on maybe tendencies, some of Mike Denbrock's play calling tendencies, throw incomplete on first down. And I think, you know, I think a lot of offensive coordinators do this, and they come back with a run. And when you have Love and Price, you can comfortably go back to a run on second and 10, you know, no doubt about that. But maybe, you know, maybe just some of the tendencies that, you know, sometimes people like to point out about Mike Denbrock's play calling.
I've hated for years the second and 10 run because he threw incomplete on first down. But I understand it when you have Jeremiah Love, because then the other problem is, well, why didn't you get Love the ball that entire series? when it's third and 10, if you throw incomplete right. again. So
yeah.
You don't have Love and Price this time, so that would be a good one. I feel like they got better because they couldn't have gotten worse at the goal to go stuff last year. They were that doesn't make any sense how bad they were at it. I think CJ Carr was part of it, and he won't be this year. I just think CJ Carr will be better at that now.
Cooper, we always point to Cooper Flanagan, him being back and him pounding at the line of scrimmage, I think makes a significant difference.
Defensively, that was a great one, Drew, because I was trying to think of one defensively. That's kind of more of an individual, but it is a coaching point. Yeah, you wonder, BYU and Miami and SMU will have Notre Dame's tendencies. Everything will be going great defensively, what they do on third down, what they do in third and long, their packages. And so that's when it becomes... You know, they always say Tim Priester, you and I say the other team has scholarships too. The other teams have coaches too, and they will be able to scout Notre Dame, which is fair. As much as we like the Notre Dame coaching staff, the other team has coaches too that can have plenty of tape on them at this point.
Question number 6, either from T. McNear or TMC Near. I'm not entirely certain which one, but if you had to buy stock in the Notre Dame true freshman entire college career, are you taking either the combination of Rodney Durham and Ian Primmer, or are you betting on the field? T.O., the floor is yours.
To be fair, he asked Dunham or Primmer or the field, but I want to make it harder for everybody. Because if it's just one guy or the field, you got to take the field, right? Well, now I've made it more difficult. I will take Dunham and Primmer together because I combined them. But Trent McNear, he had the question, he separated them. It's too easy to say the field the other way. Dunham and Primmer, are going to be very, very good as freshmen. I can't bet the field when that happens. They're going to be excellent sophomores and juniors, and we may never see them again. So I'm going with those guys.
I agree. That's very tempting to take those two. I will say there is also in the field, there are 2 5-stars there as well in Kari Adams and Joey O'Brien. And that's my main. It's hard to not take Ronnie Dunham given everything we saw this spring and all. Like, that's, I agree with all that, but I think I'll take the 2 5-stars and the other, whatever it is, 24 players in this class too. So there's, I think just statistically, I'll go that way.
Well, so who are the candidates? We would say Joey O'Brien, we'd say Kari Adams,
the running backs,
Pouncey,
maybe Aiden Pouncey.
Osborne and Pouncey.
Iwatade, Devin Fitzgerald, I think that his name may come up here a little bit. Definitely the running backs.
Do you have to take the negatives too? Because
what do you mean?
guys don't play well too. You have to take all the things that happens with their careers. It's not just the upside.
Yeah.
I don't know how low Dunham and Ian are going to go.
Yeah. I Dunham's in the rotation, right? Yeah. I mean, there's no doubt about that. We don't know about the tight end situation quite yet, but clearly the summer arrival Premier has impressed some people out there. I'll take the duo listed there because I think Dunham has a chance to be the third defensive end, frankly.
I do too. That's a great point for you guys because it's a very good field, but if it depends on how nitty gritty we get, if you can take the negatives of the field, how many negatives is Rodney Dunham going to have as a 2027 and 2028 sophomore and junior?
He needs to provide a pass rush. We saw in the spring that he's capable of providing a pass rush. I'm sure that will carry over into September.
Yeah, I'm cheating actually. So I'm taking the highlight reels of the Rodney EM combo, and I'm taking the collective production of everyone else. But I think the highlight reels, it's not close. Those two dominate in that regard.
Question number 7 from Wash ND. With Quincy Porter not being ready to go for fall camp and the somewhat lackluster performance of both Micah Gilbert and Cam Williams so far, could we see a true freshman boundary, Devin Fitzgerald, or even Ian Premmer starting against Wisconsin?
I think that they will start against someone, but I still say the starting three against Wisconsin are Faison, Graham, and Greathouse, and they can tell the boundary-specific position to take a hike. It's modern college football, and you can put Jaden Greathouse on the boundary, and he can win one-on-one once in a while, too.
I'm not ready to include Jaden Greathouse in that trio of starters just yet. Otherwise, I completely agree that Faison and Graham, as long as they're both healthy, September 6th, are sharpied into that lineup. Right, yes. They're not Agreed. Penciled. They're sharpied. But I think if it's not Greathouse, I think Gilbert has a good shot to be that third starter that day. That doesn't mean that they won't be willing to do some different things. And we sit here and we think about how it's just been 2 years, and we referenced this last week on the pod. It's just been 2 years since they opened up the competition at left tackle, and Anthony Knapp became your starting left tackle en route to a national championship game appearance. So this is a staff that wouldn't be afraid to do that, but I don't think that happens September 6th against Wisconsin.
I agree, especially since we really haven't seen Fitzgerald get those first team reps like that yet. Like if we saw him more against the top guys, then maybe I would have a stronger opinion. But right now, most of what we've seen is a lot of it's been with the third team, or he has gotten some second team reps and still made plays too. So I think he's definitely trending in the right direction, and there's a lot of reasons to be high about him this season, but maybe not in that first game in Premier. As much as I like him, it's still a different position, and he's still coming from lower level Kansas ball too. So that's going to be a big jump for him to be ready to play boundary receiver in the first game of the season when he enrolled over the summer too.
Yeah. If Tim, did you answer?
Yes. I mean, I
asked a question.
Yeah, I answered. I said Greathouse. Yeah.
Yeah. If Porter's not ready to go out of camp, I mean, I think Micah Gilbert probably starts against Wisconsin. I don't see Devin Fitzgerald starting against Wisconsin, but I do see beginning on August, what's their first practice? August 6th. Mm-hmm. I do see him, starting to get one reps, which we didn't really see in the spring, at least when we were there. But I think Fitzgerald can be in the running. I don't think Cam Williams will be because he won't be consistent enough. Gilbert's got to be better. It's a bit of an issue. If they felt Greathouse could play boundary, we would have seen him play boundary. I don't know that that's the fit. They do have a problem, competetive catches from the boundary position. So somebody's got to emerge there.
And he's an all-time competitive catcher, Jaden Greathouse. He's great at it.
Well, but I mean, from that position and going.
No, I know. I'm saying that I think he can solve it, but he's got to be healthy though. I mean, I'm jumping the gun. The Greathouse makes it through 20 camp practices.
Yeah. I think Fitzgerald has a chance to really emerge. It's when I don't think starting against Wisconsin, but if he makes it happen in the preseason, we've seen before, Marcus Freeman will absolutely start freshman if they prove themselves on the practice field.
I uh, I have nothing negative to say about Devin Fitzgerald from what we've seen. I will just caution people that 2 years ago, Micah Gilbert was the guy that coming out of spring that was going to force his way into the starting lineup, and then he didn't. And last year, Elijah Burris was the most impressive freshman they brought in 2 years in the early enrollment in the spring, and then he wasn't. So I think it gets hard. I think Fitzgerald probably has a better mindset for football than Elijah Burris did in their comparative freshman seasons, and probably Micah Gilbert. Usually somebody hits a wall somewhere along the way, those freshmen. And I think, Priester, you're right. Somebody just, Gilbert starts, and JB, you said the same thing. I still want them to look at the, this is modern college football. We can play Jaden Greathouse to that side of the field, and it'll work out.
I think they need, he needs to get on the field, man. No, he's got to act like an upperclassman and help lead that group.
Next question, RPM go Irish. We're going nationally here, guys. And he's very excited. I told him we're including it on the message board, so we had to do it. What are your, I almost waited too. What are your preseason top five teams in order? And guys, if you, unless you already did it the other way, your top five, not like predicting the AP. You know how Phil Steele does his top five, but he also predicts. What are your top five teams?
Go ahead, guys.
I can go first. I have number one, Ohio State, number two, Oregon, number three, Notre Dame, four, Texas, and five, Georgia.
All right. I can imagine. I'm looking forward to O'Malley's answer on this with his bon vivant lifestyle. Just I'm sure he spent plenty of time this summer pontificating over a glass of red wine about who his top five teams are going to be, which is why
he I have to vote soon, though. I'm involved in the poll now. I have to vote soon. So
this And so, I had to submit a ballot to USA Today recently, and my top five teams were, and I really vacillated on Ohio State or Notre Dame number one. And I went Ohio State number one, Notre Dame number two. I had Oregon number three. I had Texas number four. And I had Georgia number five. And for a bonus, and I said this on Fox Sports Radio yesterday, I also have Alabama not making the playoff this year.
I thought you were going to say number six. And I was like, wow, this just took a turn. Okay. Go ahead, TJP. I don't know if you guys ever look at the replay of that. I looked up so fast when you said Alabama right there. Oh, no. Good job, JB. I like that one. There we go.
All right. I've got at number five, I have Oregon. At number four, I have Georgia. At number three, I have Texas Tech, because Texas Tech has the, according, again, Phil Steele, I lean heavily on him at this time of year because he's had the most success in his predictions. So just going on that as I go through the first-rate series, Texas Tech, I have third because they have the worst schedule among all Power Four conference teams. So they're not going to lose during the regular season. They don't play BYU. Number two, I have Ohio State. Number one, I have Notre Dame.
I didn't consider Texas Tech because it's my ranking of how good the teams are. So I did one, flipped the coin, kind of went with Notre Dame, two, Ohio State, three, Texas, four, Georgia, and five, Oregon.
The only reason I didn't take Texas because I just think the schedule's going to trip them up.
I'm just going by how good the teams are right
now. I understand.
Right, yeah. It's because Notre Dame, well, otherwise Notre Dame would not have been 1A. They'd have been one because Ohio State's schedule's terrible compared to Notre Dame's schedule. That is what's – Ohio State's schedule's brutal, man.
Yeah. I do want to add that, like, from talking with people, including a couple of different coaches who had quarterbacks at the Manning Passing Academy, like CJ Carr acquitted himself just so excellently there, and frankly better than Arch Manning. Like, it was easy for me to rank Notre Dame ahead of Texas, even though there's so much hoopla surrounding Texas this year. And the supporting cast for Arch Manning is going to be incredibly good. Their offensive line is considered even better than Notre Dame's offensive line. He's got some pass catchers that are true NFL, maybe top 10 type picks with the Cam Coleman coming over from Auburn. And so CJ Carr was an absolute differentiator for me in putting Notre Dame ahead of the Horns.
Yeah, I mean, I think Texas is loaded, but I think that their schedule's difficult enough and that they've been tripped up by teams that you don't expect them to get tripped up by, you know, too frequently for me to pick them.
Final question, Matt Tebby. What is one unanswered but crucial question on offense and on defense that you're most interested in fall camp? Hard part here to guys, he adds, how will you know if that question is answered? I can answer that part. We won't. So go ahead and ask your question because we won't see it. Unfortunately, we will not be seeing Notre Dame in a full practice after August 6th. We cannot answer this question for you until Wisconsin.
Yeah, but you know, everything's personnel related here. Boundary wide receiver, and you know, God forbid something happens to CJ Carr, and you have to go to a young guy that's just totally unproven. On defensive side, the nickel position. You know, I mean, I think I'm not as skeptical maybe as you guys are about Christian Gray being able to play nickel, and yet he hasn't played it. And yeah, it's a very, very difficult position to play. How does he respond if he has some issues early on? By the way, if I could change the subject here real quick about Colton Joseph, I know we've talked about him a lot, and I've said a lot of great things about him with Wisconsin. I've continued to watch film on him, and I think that he's a two-pick candidate against Notre Dame in the opener. But nickel is my great concern on the defensive side of the ball.
They could all be two-pick candidates against Notre Dame.
Well, no doubt about it. But he is not a, you know, the more you watch him, and he, you know, he's a dynamic athlete. He's really a dynamic athlete. His accuracy at times is not as sharp as it needs to be.
I think mine on defense is similar to yours, especially if we don't have an obvious answer at that field corner. Like, what do they do there too? Would they feel the need to move Christian Gray back potentially too? And then are they do they have a better option nickel after Gray? Like, I'm kind of curious on just how those things shake out and if that's ultimately going to be his position. If DJ McKinney starts, you know, playing to the level that he did, especially 2 years ago at Colorado when he's opposite Travis Hunter. If he can play like that, then that, I think, really sets you up. Or does Kari Adams kind of step up in there, or Dallas Golden? Like, so there's just a lot of question marks at that other spot. And then running backs, I mean, we kind of already touched on it with the short yardage. Is that something that they feel like they have a better handle of, especially against this defensive line, which I think will be much improved? As you mentioned, we're not going to see anything without full pads in the first practice. This is going to give us any idea, but I think that's going to be really critical to the season and something they need to hope they have kind of coming out of fall camp.
Yeah, for me, it's the wide receiver position, not just boundary or whatever. It's just collectively, how is that group? How does everyone mesh into roles? It's not just Quincy Porter. Do we finally see Jaden Greathouse able to play? If it's a 14 game schedule, is he able to play 12? Or if it's 16, is he able to play 14? Whatever. Like, what are we going to actually see from Jaden Greathouse and Porter? And then where do they go beyond that? Who else steps up? So that's it for me on the offensive side of the ball. Defensively, I have a lot of belief in what Notre Dame's going to get done at the nickel position. And I think it may end up proving to be a very good fit for Christian Gray. We all know that this is clearly far and away the best defensive line and the deepest defensive line that Notre Dame will have fielded under Marcus Freeman and going back even beyond that under Brian Kelly for a number of years. But we still have to see the production. So those are the two for me. Like, the defensive line, we think there's a bunch of strong candidates to anchor the middle and to be disruptive off the edges. But we still have to see it, especially with KVA coming back from injury and Madden Foramo coming back from the wrist injury, and just Jalen Snead, as you pointed out last week, T.O., is he 2024 Snead or 2025 Snead? On and on and on. So those are the two for me.
I struggle with one defensively because I think they just find answers with their depth. So of all the things you guys discussed, I got to side with Priester on the nickel. I think Christian Gray can handle the nickel against a lot of teams. And how does he handle the nickel against? I think he gets removed from the nickel against Miami, but how do they handle the nickel in the playoff game?
That was a conversation on a message board that he won't be playing nickel against
Miami. I brought that up on January 1st, not January 1st, when did Malachi Toney play in the championship game? Late January, that Leonard Moore will cover Malachi Toney when Notre Dame plays
him. Somebody's got to defend Cooper Barkley, too.
By that time, it's your boy, Kari Adams, as long as he matures. No, that's going to be my hot take, by the way. Adams takes his spot this year, just like Leonard Moore and Benjamin Morrison did. Offensively, since you guys already handled the definite obvious, the backup quarterback and boundary receiver, all right, is the offensive line playoff qualifying or playoff winning? They don't have to be week one. Obviously, no one is. But sometimes everybody just assumes Notre Dame's offensive line is going to go dominate playoff games.
We'll see where Ashton Craig is. Everybody's very high on Will Black, but he'll be making his first start on September 6th. So could be a bump or two in the road and guys changing positions. I don't think Gerby Lambert is necessarily going to struggle going from right guard to right tackle, but you're a little bit more on an island out there. So those are things that can crop up.
Yeah, they were always, I mean, look, they're going to be one of the best lines in the country. Notre Dame's offensive line will be one of the best lines in the country, but are they Joe Moore Award finalists where we believe they're a Joe Moore Award finalist, or are they like some of the other guys that were the top 12 lines, which is absolutely fine, but fell a little bit short of all of our preseason expectations? These are not huge problems to have. Notre Dame's camp problems we're looking at compared to other teams. These are not, I mean, because you can't count injuries, so these are not huge problems to have. Notre Dame's well positioned for camp, and we will not have an answer in camp for any of these, but we will have an answer in late September, probably. You guys can just take the time off and come back to the podcast in late September, or we'll give everybody the answer. Don't do that. Come back on Monday, July 27th, when we reconvene for another edition of Irish Illustrated Insider. Notre Dame may have added a primetime defensive tackle to its future by that point as well. For John Bryce, USA Today, Tim Priester, and Drew Mintock of Irish Illustrated, I'm Tim O'Malley. Thank you for watching and listening again, Irish Illustrated Insider.